Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Julia LaRose Show. Making her debut on the pod is Amy Nixon. She is a housing and economics analyst based out of Dallas-Fort Worth. You might know her on Twitter or X as Texas Runner DFW, where she shares all things related to the housing market. In this episode, Amy shares why she's taking a six-month hiatus from doing financial podcasts. She talked about how she pivoted on her recession call from last year and that we might not even see that deflationary recession call that she had last year, maybe not until 2025. We talked about the state of the housing market, why it's very much status quo for the remainder of the year, and we got an update on her famed Airbnb bust thesis. I really enjoyed this conversation with Amy. I learned a lot, and I think you will too. Amy Nixon, housing and economic analyst. It is so great to welcome you on the show and great to see you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me, Amy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Amy, I love interacting with you on Twitter, now known as X, and you've also been a supporter of this show, and I am absolutely thrilled to welcome you on. And I'd like to start where I always start, and that is to get my guest, you know, macro view, the framework in which they are looking at the economy today. What is the big picture macro view for you? And Amy, take all the time you need to set the table.
Oh, gosh. There's a lot going on right now. This is probably one of the most challenging macro environments, which is why I think there's been so much excitement around podcasts and discussion, because there are so many different things going on that are unusual to occur together at the same time. I would say the big picture thing that you need to keep in mind right now is we have tight monetary policy relative to what we've seen recently in history. And we have loose fiscal policy. And that fiscal policy piece is the piece that's changed in the last 6 months. We entered 2023 with tight monetary policy that was continuing to tighten and relatively tight fiscal policy. So a lot of us, and I'm included in this group, had forecasted based off of that, that we were going to go into recession in 2023 and that those tightening conditions combined were going to lead us into some economic problems by the end of 23. And I'll be honest with you, I am humbled by markets all the time. And this is honestly, in full disclosure, my first podcast that I've done in 6 months. I took a 6 month hiatus because I got to a place where I realized that the markets were not behaving the way that I had anticipated that they would. There were pieces of policy that were changing rapidly. And I got to a point where I realized we're not going to have a recession by the end of 2023. And I'm not even sure we're going to have one in 2024, at least not a deflationary one. And I have seen in my short time that I've been in the financial media space that the finfluencer crowd, I'm throwing my own under the bus, but I'll be honest, you know, I'm being completely honest with you. There is a tendency in this space to move to protect ego, both our own and our audiences. And I did not want to shortchange my analysis and simply punt forward my 23 forecast into 24, which is kind of the default method that you see a lot of times in this space when people are, you know, bull versus bear, doomer versus optimist. There tends to be a tendency for people to simply say, well, I'm not wrong, or I wasn't wrong, I just was early or not right yet. And I think that's really doing a disservice to both ourselves and to people who are listening to us, because especially in the realm of money management, if I'm wrong, okay, I'm wrong. And maybe I, you know, missed 40% of a bull run because I was wrong. I still have 60% upside that I could get for myself or for my clients if I recognize where I went wrong and stop and take the time to analyze the new data that's come into the market to change things. You can still go out and get that. And the only thing worse to me than being wrong is staying wrong. So this macro environment is very humbling, to say the least, and I have had to change a lot of what I expected in 2023 and pivot a little bit going into this year, which is proving to be a tough year.
Yeah. Well, Amy, I have to say, I appreciate you spelling that out for us and, you know, explaining, like, you know, it has been a humbling environment. Also, I didn't realize you had taken the hiatus, but I'm honored to have you on my show for your return. And you were mentioning, like, you've had to change maybe your own analysis. Can you share a bit more there? Or walk us through, like, what has changed or evolved for you?
Sure. I can kind of talk you through what I went through last year. I started to recognize a shift in both Powell's FOMC speeches around his language, his verbiage around the housing market and how he was talking about the housing market, as well as a shift in markets in general, which everybody picked up on the shift in markets in general. When those fiscal conditions loosened, the markets all started to rip. So that was more noticeable, I think, to a lot of people. But that was combined with what I saw as a subtle shift in Powell's language. And a lot of people are hard on Powell, but I give him credit in the fact that he has been pretty consistently telling us what he's trying to do and what he's going to do. So when he came out in June and he said, I'm seeing signs that the housing market may have bottomed. That's something that he said in the June FOMC conference. That was a little bit of a wait, what moment for me, because I didn't, you know, at that point in time, we hadn't really seen prices correct across the nation on a national level. Case-Shiller ended the year up last year about 4.5%. So that was a little bit of an alarm to me, because prior to that, he hadn't said anything along those lines. And prior to that, he had used a lot of language of ownership, and it was proactive language of ownership, meaning we need to get a place of supply and demand balance back. We young people are unable to afford homes. We need to do X, Y, Z. And he would say this during meetings where he was hiking. So the communication I was getting from him was, there is something that we can do with monetary policy to help the housing market. And that it went from that to in June, him saying, it looks like things have bottomed, to by November, when all my alarm bells were going off, him saying, using language of what I would say it was more passive and it was more sort of responsibility off for the Fed, where he used language like, there's just not enough supply and there's nothing that we can do about it. Kind of, I'm sorry, it's not my problem anymore language. And that sort of signaled to me that the Fed recognized that the rate hikes were only going to be able to do so much against the backdrop of fiscal stimulus that we have going on. And that's why, you know, we ended the year up in home prices like 4.5% on a nominal basis. They were flat, real. But that is where I saw a clear pivot. And I also saw that the same language sort of shift happened around inflation and rate cut expectations as well. Because that November meeting was where there was the clear pivot to talking about 6 rate hikes for 24. And in light of that,
Wait, was that rate hikes or rate cuts?
I'm sorry, rate cuts.
Yes.
Rate cuts. It's a Monday.
It's all good.
Yeah, 6 rate cuts. And that was coming from in the backdrop of data that was still clearly showing inflation shooting above that 2% target. Although it was, we did see a lot of disinflationary movement last year. It kind of started to stall out last summer. And we didn't really get, we never got, you know, really in the 2s. And we sort of were hovering in that 3. And it looked like it was kind of forming a new bottom in the 3s. And I was concerned to hear, you know, 6 rate cuts with that inflation level. And that's when I shifted to thinking deflationary recession is always out there as a black swan freak event because we have a credit-based economy that is so indebted. So I'm not saying there's a 0% chance of a recession this year in 24 that's going to be deflationary. But my base case is not that. My base case is we're going to be running inflation too hot, like shooting 3-4% for most of this year with a struggle to keep it down.
Yeah. You know, you're mentioning housing, and this is an area that I know you, I feel like I get on my analysis on the housing market from your Twitter feed, because it is so good. It is so prolific. So everyone definitely go check out Texas Runner DFW. Can we get your take on the housing sector today? Just kind of frame it up for us. Like, how is housing from where you stand?
Housing's in a tough spot in these conditions because of what I said earlier. We have tight credit, so it's hard to get a loan still if you're a regular person. And it is honestly still hard for institutions. We've seen institutionals step back. They are still buying, but they have stepped back from what they were doing in 21, 22. And we also have a lot of liquidity, money out there, capital. All stock markets at all-time high, crypto all-time high. Pretty much every asset market's at all-time high. Housing's still at all-time highs. So there's just a really low transaction volume, which is what we were plagued with last year with housing. And that continued to roll into this year. And because there's low transactions, there's not a lot of price discovery. And prices are sort of hanging on. And I expect prices to continue to more or less hang on in a national level this year. I think they're going to be nominal, flatter, slightly up, and real negative. Because like I said, I think inflation is going to be running like 3-4%. And in terms of certain markets that were showing distress last year that I talked about a lot last year, there's markets that are oversaturated with vacation rentals. There's markets like Florida where they've just been hammered by insurance costs and a lot of inventory in some of those vacation rental areas. And markets like in the Sun Belt where there was building. There was a distinction last year where there was building versus not because it was such a low inventory-led market. The places that were able to build new inventory were able to have a little bit more price discovery. Builders were selling last year. A highest percentage ever of new construction in our housing market sales was last year because builders were the only ones getting deals done. They were giving you a 5% rate. They were buying rates down, most of them. So markets like the Sun Belt where we had a lot of building, they had more price discovery, price correction. Austin was negative. Some of the just really overheated markets, San Francisco was negative because they had a lot of tech unemployment and the prices just got too high for anybody. Those markets are going to continue to struggle this year. The ones that were struggling under the rates being high, because the high rates still do put negative pressure on demand and on housing. But because liquidity is high again, and we've got all these other markets at all-time highs, there's enough to keep it propped up, I think, through the end of the year. I think the election's going to be a pivotal point for the future of what macro is going to look like in 25.
Hey there. I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of this episode. Yeah, when I hear you say like it's enough to keep it propped up, it kind of makes me wonder like, is it a healthy market? What do you think?
It's an odd market. It's healthy in the way that there are transactions happening, but it's not healthy in the sense that it's not the volume of transactions that we're used to, and not even close. And there's a lot of forces at play that are keeping it a little bit frozen. So in my opinion, a healthy market would have a lot of price discovery. It would have a little bit more liquidity where things are changing hands and where people feel free to move, basically, to put their property on the market. And there's people, everybody right now, the majority of people have a rate below 4%, an interest rate below 4%. And with the rates not being cut like people expected, you have to buy at 7%. And with prices being what they are, a lot of people are priced out. Mm-hmm. I get messages every day from people who say, I can't afford to move. We need another bedroom. You know, my wife just had a baby. Or there's real life pieces or reasons why people move that are not just financial pro con, can I make money on this deal? And so I would not say it's healthy for normal families at all. It's maybe healthy for investors because they're controlling it more than they ever have, with a lot of deals being done in cash, percentage-wise. But that's only because regular people aren't able to get credit or afford the credit.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're both millennials, and I'm thinking about, like, we finally found a city that we love, that we want to live in. And it's just like, there's like hardly anything like comes online. And if it does, just like snapped up immediately. They're crazy expensive for like the square footage. You're like, wait, what? The prices? I feel like as a millennial, I almost feel like I've been like a little priced out. Maybe I'm trying to be patient to see like maybe prices come down. I don't know. Like, what is kind of your take on like the millennials? Because we're at that age where a lot of us are like forming households, but we're not able to buy houses.
I know. This is a big part of what I have my account for, is to speak for the younger generations, because it really does feel like it's sort of not fair the way that the market has evolved. It is becoming further and further away for people to reach that American dream. And I wish I could say, like, yeah, we're going to get this massive price correction and it across the board and everything's going to be affordable again. But it's hard to make that call in an environment where our money keeps being debased. And I think we saw in 2008 that even where there was a serious price correction nationally, it was coinciding with a lot of trauma in the economy. So a lot of people that say, oh, we just need a recession to wipe everything clean and reset all these prices and all these markets that got away from fundamentals. You have to remember, when we're in that position, you're going to be happy if you have a job. You're probably not going to be looking at Zillow to see, you know, can I buy this house? You're going to be looking at your boss to try to get signals if you're still going to have a job in 6 months. And I think it's tough because the direction it seems to be headed is, and the NAR lawsuit was another piece of this. That was just in the news. It's moving towards an automated, easier to sell to institution market. By removing sort of that middleman realtor, it's one step away from human contact. And whenever you start to put barriers with that human element or move further from that human element, you are positioning something to become more institutionalized or institutional owned or investor owned, basically.
Okay. So you mentioned the NAR. I've kind of followed it, like listened to a couple podcasts on it. Can you explain that bit? Because that's an interesting angle on it too, when you remove the human from it, the implications there. Just want to get your reaction to that news.
So the NAR, I mean, they've been embroiled in kind of scandals and lawsuits since, I think it was like last spring. But they finally came out with this final verdict, basically saying that this, what's sort of been the accepted standard 6% commission for realtors, which was usually the seller would pay it and it would be split between the two agents. So the seller would pay their own agent 3%, and then the seller would pay out of that. The buyer agent would be given the other 3%. And there were obviously realtors who didn't do this. Along the way, they discovered, hey, we can make a market out of this. I'll offer you 4% and we'll do 2 and 2. And you saw proliferation of that in 21 when the market was super competitive and anybody was trying to get a deal. So in some ways, you could argue that the 6% was never set in stone, because it was never set in stone. It was just sort of the accepted standard. But by removing it sort of more officially from the NAR language, they're taking steps in the direction of making a buyer agent less important to the transaction. And this is something, by the way, that many companies have already been trying to do for the last 10 years. Zillow, Redfin, all of these, Open Door, they said, hey, the middleman is just adding extra cost to everybody, the seller and the buyer. Why don't we you know, just tour this home virtually online, make an offer, and who needs an agent? The real estate agent benefits a family. That's who needs an agent. A family who wants somebody that understands the neighborhood, who wants somebody to walk them through homes personally and tour and explain different things about the home in the neighborhood, and who wants to feel like they have an advocate. That's who the real estate agent is really there for. So by making real estate agents less necessary with the sort of promise of, oh, well, this might save you a little bit of transaction costs. What it's actually doing, though, is making things easier for investors and these tech companies to own the market and run the market. Like, that's really what's going to be, I think, the long-term trajectory of what flows out of this judgment. And I don't like to see that because the human element of the housing market is what I'm here for. And I've seen how investors impacted the market so much in 21 and pretty much in since COVID. Investors have just come like vultures on any affordable housing in a lot of metros and just turned them all into rentals.
Yeah.
And that's not something that I want to see for people and for our future. And unfortunately, I just don't see what's going to make them stop. Because even in this tighter credit market with rates hiked and cap rates not being very favorable anymore, in terms of it takes a lot of work now to find a property that's actually going to cash flow and the numbers run right with prices and rates the way they are today. But investors are still getting deals done and they're still making cash offers because I think long term they see what I've been seeing lately, which is that our money's going to continue to get debased. And that means hard assets are where you want your money to be parked to protect yourself.
Yeah. Do you think it's the right way to think about housing or owning a home as an investment? Is that the right way to look at it?
It's complicated. I think, and the thing I get asked the most, by the way, is this a good time for me to buy a home or should my family buy this home? It's a person who's got a family and a life, and they're literally asking about shelter. Like, do I rent my shelter or do I buy my shelter? And this is one of the periods in history where it's really tough call because it's in most markets, it's roughly $1,000 a month less to rent a similar property than what your monthly payment would be if you bought and put, you know, 10% down. So there's a huge delta right now between renting and buying in terms of like the same quality property. You're going to have a much cheaper monthly payment if you rent in almost every market right now, which is unusual. This is not the way it's historically been. Those two numbers tend to want to converge. But at the same time, the reason I've always liked housing for a normal family for an investment is because the average person doesn't have a lot of financial education. They don't have a lot of investment knowledge. And for a lot of people, their home, older people right now, their home is the only investment that they own. And so when they're saying, should I rent or buy, what I'm hearing from them or what I'm envisioning from them is they don't own any assets. And by buying, they're going to own an asset. Even if they don't get in at a great price and they have a, you know, a relatively high interest rate, they're going to own an investment. And when you see the numbers from NAR or all these pro housing ownership industry places that show the wealth gap between renters and buyers, it's pronounced and it shows that homeowners are far above in terms of wealth renters. And I think the reason for that is because, not because renting is bad for wealth building, but because most people who own a home, that's their only investment. So if you know that you're not an investor and you're not going to outsource investing by paying a financial advisor to invest your capital, renting is not going to do you any favors. You're better off to buy and use that for savings vehicle, even if you don't come out super ahead in terms of price appreciation. Like, we can't expect to get what the boomers got in terms of price appreciation. When you buy, you should go in with the expectation of, I'm going to own this property free and clear in 30 years. And it'll probably have gone up nominally in value. But I don't know how much. You can't expect that it's going to go up the way it went the last 20 years. So if you're not going to buy and you're renting, I think that you actually could come out far ahead financially of the buyers if you know how to invest that capital. If you can invest that delta between renting and buying and invest that $50,000 down payment, you're going to come out ahead as a renter. And this, the obvious example that I always give people is last year, 23. You bought a house. By the end of 23, it went up 4.5%, about the same as inflation. You zero real return on your home. If you'd taken your $50,000 down payment, put it into Bitcoin, you'd be way, way ahead. Or equities, you'd be way, way ahead. But if you know you're a person who's afraid of Bitcoin or afraid of the stock market, or you know, you put your money, you're like, I'll put my down payment in the stock market and the stock market corrects 15% and you freak out and pull it out, or you pull it out and take a vacation, you're not gonna beat the buyer in 15 years. So it comes down to how well you know yourself as an investor. And it, and if you're not a savvy or risk-taking at all investor, you're probably safer off just buying a primary home if you can afford it. If you can afford it.
Yeah.
A lot of people can't right now. So it's not even a question. They have to rent.
Yeah. And also, I imagine competing against institutional buyers makes it even more tricky for folks. Let me ask you this. Where are we in the Airbnb bust thesis? You put out a thesis that got a lot of attention on X around Airbnb. Can you frame up that thesis and where we are?
Sure. That was sort of, what I came out on the scene as. I got known for that term. I made it up. I didn't make up the term. And it was predicated on where I saw the speculation in the housing market cycle. So in 2008, what I saw as the speculatory element was flipping homes. The speculation was based on the housing market had never gone down nationally in a significant way. So prices were just going to keep going up. You could buy five homes, flip them. And that's what people were doing. This time around, the speculation was landlordism. Everybody wanted to get a property at these low rates and passive income cash flow the property. And the most extreme version of that is a short-term rental, because it's going to give you the maximum return of dollar for in a month if you're getting decent occupancy for a property. And it sort of rewrote the rules of a cap rate underwrite, because if you're underwriting for, I think this property is going to get me $2,000 a month from a family versus, I think this property is going to get me $250 a night from a vacationer, then suddenly you can value that property a lot higher. And because we had a post-pandemic travel boom with a lot of people suddenly wanting to take, you know, six vacations because they missed out on 2 years of travel. And that was combined with stimulus checks and stock market at all-time highs and crypto at all-time highs. Everybody was, you know, feeling rich and wanting to take a bunch of trips. So occupancy was great. Airbnb stock was off the charts. But it felt like a party that was going to come to an end. And to be honest with you, the entire bust idea was predicated on that 23 recession, which we did not get. But I will say, even without the recession, there were a few markets that did go bust. Palm Springs is the main one in California that everybody was talking about early on. There's properties there that were selling for like $1.5 million that are now selling for $650,000. But that has to do with regulations that were put on by Airbnb. So there were a couple elements to the idea of a bust. And the main ones were demand was artificially high and it was going to pull back, whether that was just because it was too high from post-pandemic euphoria, or what I thought was going to combine with that would be a recession and job loss and people tightening their belts, because vacation is the first thing to go when you're worried about money. So it was going to be a pullback in demand. An oversupply was the second piece, because everybody kept buying them and wanting to buy them. And certain markets were just exponentially growing in options of rentals. And it's like, how many people can take a vacation at the same time to the same place and fill these things? we saw occupancy drop off last year, off a sort of filtering back to that 2019 level. So that travel boom waned and occupancy returned back to sort of normal levels. So people that were overextended to buy a property that took out a loan, and loans, while the residential housing market were very solid after the first financial crisis, there was a little bit of looser lending conditions in the investment loan realm with the, they're called DSCR loans, which are basically loans given not based on your income at all. They're based on what you think the property is going to produce in revenue. And those revenue estimates were often being made with 2021 numbers of occupancy, which again were the peak post-COVID euphoria numbers of occupancy. So they were a little bit unrealistic, and entire loans were being given to people off of that data. And I just saw that that was going to come to a head for a lot of people. And it did. There were a lot of investors last year who sort of got underwater or over their head with a property that wasn't cash flowing. But it was a little bit of a quiet fallout in the same way that we've seen in commercial real estate, because essentially Airbnb is commercial real estate. It's using residential homes for commercial purposes. So what we saw was similar to what we saw in the commercial market with office space and multifamily. We saw larger investors, say a guy who's got 100 Airbnbs somewhere nationally, come in and take that guy who's got three that are struggling and sort of do an off-table deal. Or not even necessarily where the real estate changes hands, where he sort of just absorbs the LLC that that other guy had into his. So that you wouldn't even see a transaction in terms of the real estate in those situations. And then that keeps the prices from really being discovered. So it was a little bit more of a transfer from smaller independent hosts to larger hosts. That's kind of how it played out last year. And it wasn't the, I think what people hoped it would be was, oh, these homes are going to go back for families to use. Like they're going to go back in the MLS and be listed to families. But what tends to happen in markets is people like sells to like first. So where you've got that boomer that raised his kids in this home for 20 years, he wants to find that young family and sell it to that young family. When you've got an investor who bought a property and is going under on it, they're going to go call their investor friends and say, who can give me a cash deal? Get me out of this right now. And that's what happened.
Interesting. Well, I have to say, Amy, it's been a fascinating conversation just listening to you and learning from you. I've learned so much in this half hour. I want to give you the final few minutes here, Amy, to share, you know, any parting thoughts, anything that didn't come up in this conversation that you'd like to bring up with this audience, and also let folks know where they can follow you and your work.
Sure. I think the biggest thing that I'm looking at this year is the inflation. What we've seen in Q1 is that it's still an issue, and that fiscal spending is kind of running the show and has been for about 6 months, and that debt ceiling is suspended through 25. So I anticipate this year to be a little bit what I call more of the same in terms of inflation running a bit hot, growth in the real economy continuing to struggle a little bit on the fringes because of that tight monetary policy. Housing to be relatively flat, possibly negative in real terms. That's sort of my base case expectation for this year. And that deflationary recession that I talked about a lot last year, I would say that the odds would be higher for something like that in 2025 than 2024. So that's just obviously a lot of people thought recession last year, we didn't get one. But I have pivoted on that recession, and I'm not just punting it to this year. I'm actually moving it out to another year out.
Is that because like post-election, or just because the forces at play this year keeping things going?
I think it has a little bit to do with both. I think that political is driving a lot of what's happening in this economy. And I think that as long as there is that debt ceiling suspension through January, there's going to be the ability to use fiscal spending to sort of patch things together. And the most politically palpable solution to what we have right now is to let inflation run a little bit hot, like 3 to 4%, and sort of, whether they state it or not, make that the new baseline. Because we have such a divisive political backdrop right now that the idea of cutting entitlements or cutting or raising taxes, which is what we'd have to do to make our debt payments, it's got to be, there's only three options. And a sort of stealth inflation tax is the least painful politically. And during an election year, I cannot fathom they would not choose that. So that's what that's based on, that expectation that we're kind of just going to have more of the status quo for this year.
Well, Amy Nixon, analyst for the housing market and also just economics, really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And everyone go follow Amy. She is Texas, what is it? Texas Runner, DFW on Twitter. Yes. Texas Runner DFW. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, your ideas, your support of the show. It is so great to finally get to chat with you in person. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.